From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to In the Moment. And welcome to this week's news podcast. Stanley Patrick Weber was convicted on Friday the 27th of September of 11 counts of sexual abuse against four Pine Ridge boys who were his patients. The former Indian Health Services pediatrician was prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the trial took place in the federal courthouse in Rapid City. Weber was previously convicted in Montana of similar charges and sentenced to 18 years in prison. Weber's crimes garnered national attention, in particular in a joint investigation by PBS's Frontline and the Wall Street Journal. In March, the White House announced it was forming a task force to determine how abuse could have happened for 20 years in two states without IHS's knowing about it and stopping it. Jurors heard testimony from the four victims, now grown men, as well as three other victims whose testimony bolstered the government's case. SDPB's Victoria Wicks sat through the trial and reported during the week. Links to her coverage can be found online, along with this report. In her writing, she draws on the information she heard in the courtroom, her interview with South Dakota's U.S. Attorney Ron Parsons, and her own 14-year experience assisting crime victims. Here's Victoria Wicks with the report.
In Rapid City, over the course of 2 days, seven victims testified to the rape, sexual contact, and indignities Stanley Weber committed against them when they were children. They're not children anymore, not on the outside. They're grown men, and some of them are tattooed and tough and a little bit frightening. But as they speak, the scared and scarred little boys that still live within can be heard. One of the victims, we'll call him Eric, says he's been on his own since he was 10 years old. One of the lawyers asks him if he had gone to school. He replies that you can't wake up, take a shower, have breakfast, and wait at the bus stop when you live in a car. So, no school. Eric is 32 years old and currently lives at the South Dakota State Penitentiary. He sits in the witness box wearing inmate garb and handcuffs. Of the seven victims testifying, he had the longest association with Weber. He got into trouble young, and after his grandmother died, he was rejected by relatives. His father and mother had separated and formed new families, and he didn't fit into either one of them. He turned to Weber for money, a place to crash, and the kind of support usually given by kin. He says he wanted Weber to adopt him. He thought Weber loved him. This victim testifies that after he went to prison and had access to television, he started watching Law & Order, SVU, and discovered that what Weber had done to him was a crime. About that same time, an investigator came to talk with him about Weber, further emphasizing the criminal nature of the relationship. In closing arguments, federal prosecutor Sarah Collins points out that the other victims revealed anger, sorrow, embarrassment, and shame when talking about the physical acts Weber forced them into. But Eric started crying when he said he learned Weber had used him for sex, when he realized that Weber didn't love him. "Broke my heart," Eric said, as he dropped his head and lifted his manacled hands to push up his glasses and wipe tears from his eyes. The children Weber chose as victims shared some characteristics that left them defenseless. U.S. Attorney Ron Parsons explains.
You know, the evidence at trial came out that these children were, in many ways, groomed by the defendant here. He selected the ones that didn't have family support, the ones that seemed the most vulnerable, the ones that he thought he could get away with molesting. This defendant befriended these people before he raped and molested them. It's tragic, but that's a pattern that we see.
Victims of childhood abuse, especially those who don't tell, or those who tell but aren't believed, might develop one or more behaviors from a predictable set. They act out in anger, run away, become depressed, abuse alcohol or other drugs, have troubled personal relationships, become promiscuous. Some cut themselves or starve themselves or try to kill themselves. Some succeed. Some commit crimes. Of the seven victims who testified at Weber's most recent trial, two were prison inmates, another was on work release, and at least one was on probation. Weber was charged with abusing only four of the Pine Ridge victims in this trial. Two of the other witnesses had been sexually assaulted in Montana, where Weber had already been convicted and sentenced. The other one is a Pine Ridge resident, now 40 years old, and as a witness, he is angry and emphatic. In a deep, growling voice, he blasts out answers to the prosecutor's questions and uses graphic terms to describe what Weber did to him, jabbing his finger toward the defendant more than once to point out who had raped him. He says he went to Weber for physicals because he wanted to play sports in school. He went back because he thought the examinations were necessary for school, even though every time the same thing happened. Weber fondled the boy's genitals, put on a blue glove, and shoved his fingers into the boy's rectum. I thought I was getting molested, the witness says, but he didn't tell anyone. I kept it deep down in my heart. Eventually, he says, he quit sports and dropped out of school. The fact that Weber was convicted in Montana was not allowed into evidence, but details of those crimes were. Ron Parsons explains that balancing act.
Sometimes evidence is relevant, but is still so unfairly prejudicial that it should not be admitted. One of the weighings that courts have made over the years is that prior convictions usually don't come in, the fact that someone has been convicted of similar acts. However, if a jury can hear a witness testify about a similar act and decide for themselves whether that witness is credible, that's evidence they can use in determining whether the defendant has a tendency or a proclivity to commit the same kind of acts that he's charged with in the current case.
There are hazards in bringing in witnesses who are handcuffed and wearing jail clothes. The jury might get a negative impression that the witness is either weak or dangerous, felonious, captured by justice, not believable. That's how Stanley Weber looked at the pretrial conference on September 23rd. There he was wearing a red-striped jail jumpsuit and handcuffs. Small, stooped, gray, balding, bespectacled, old, captured by justice. And he had been in Montana, but in South Dakota he was still innocent until proven guilty. And so he wore a facade of innocence at his Rapid City trial, decked out in a black suit and white shirt. Ron Parsons says that veneer is vital to preserve the defendant's right to a fair trial.
We don't want the jury to render a verdict simply because they believe he's been convicted previously of similar acts.
At trial, Weber doesn't call any witnesses, and he exercises his ongoing constitutional right to remain silent, a decision the jury is instructed not to interpret as a sign of guilt. Instead, Denver attorney Harvey Steinberg makes Weber's case by cross-examining the government's witnesses and drawing conclusions in closing arguments. He points to the victim's inconsistent memories, and he calls the investigation inadequate. One witness says he was with his grandmother when he saw Weber in a parking lot. Why didn't the investigator interview the grandmother? Another witness says he told his stepfather there was blood in the toilet after he used it, although he did not tell that Weber had raped him earlier that day. Why wasn't the stepfather interviewed? Steinberg also defended Weber in Montana, and he's appealing the conviction there. Weber is 70 years old, and he's serving an 18-year sentence. There's a good chance he'll die before serving out that term. But Parsons says his team decided to try Weber in South Dakota anyway because the Pine Ridge victims also deserve justice.
They deserved to have their day in court, to have their stories told, to have their truth come out, and they deserved to have a verdict rendered against Stanley Patrick Weber for what he did to them.
In Rapid City, justice came swiftly. The jury came back about 4 hours after leaving the courtroom to deliberate, and during that time they had lunch. Parsons says he hopes the verdict vindicates the children who didn't tell anyone because they didn't think their accusations against a doctor would be believed.
I'm proud of these victims. I'm proud of the men who testified about being sexually assaulted, raped, molested as boys by their pediatrician. We stand by them, and we're glad, and we hope this brings them some measure of peace. And the fact that these men were able to come forward and finally tell their stories and have a jury hear them and render justice based on their testimony, we're just incredibly proud and grateful.
The jury believed them.
The jury believed them.
Stanley Weber's sentencing will happen a few months from now, and in the interim, a federal court services officer will conduct a pre-sentence investigation. The officer will interview Stanley Weber, if he chooses to speak. Because he might appeal, he still has the right not to incriminate himself, and the officer will talk with the men who testified. At sentencing, these victims will once again have the opportunity to be heard. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.
For the last three decades, farms in South Dakota and around the United States have trended towards bigger operations focusing on growing one or two commodity crops. Proponents of regenerative agriculture aim to reverse that trend by adding more animal and crop diversity in order to make farming more sustainable, both economically and environmentally. SDPB looks at the future of farming this month. Jacqueline Severin brings you this story.
Blue Dasher is a small farm located north of Brookings, South Dakota. It's just 53 acres, but it's full of life. Not only are there typical farm animals such as chickens, sheep, and pigs, but there are bees, fruit trees, native prairie, and seed crops such as borage, sweet clover, and Canada wild rye. Along with the bees buzzing around are a myriad of insects and birds. This diversity, says Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, is a key part of regenerative agriculture.
Regenerative agriculture is kind of takes what sustainable agriculture used to do and kind of amps it up to the next level, where we kind of started to look around the scientists and the farmers and the ranchers and the beekeepers and realize that sustaining, well, we've degraded our natural resource base in agriculture to the point where just sustaining that just isn't going to get us where we have to go. So we actually have to be rebuilding our natural resource base while generating a profitable farm.
Lundgren is an entomologist and agroecologist. He is also the director of Blue Dasher Farm and the Ecdysis Foundation, which does scientific research on regenerative farming practices. Not long ago, Lundgren had a very successful career working for the USDA. He even received an award from the Obama administration for his agricultural research. But that all changed when he was challenged by some farmers who were practicing regenerative agriculture and beekeepers who said pesticides were killing their bees. At first, Lundgren didn't believe them, but like any good scientist, he decided to conduct his own research, and what he found supported their claims.
And as a scientist, I'm inherently a skeptical person, and so I wanted to test those ideas. And also as a scientist, if I see data that suggests that I was wrong all along, then I have to be flexible enough that I change. And that's what happened with me.
Lundgren decided to start his own working farm where he could test and demonstrate regenerative agricultural practices. Lundgren says there are four key principles in regenerative farming. 1, stop tilling the soil. 2, never leave soil bare. 3, introduce plant diversity. And 4, incorporate animals into cropping. Lundgren says regenerative farms use less pesticides and herbicides because they work with nature, promoting plant diversity and attracting beneficial insects, which helps control pests and weeds.
On Blue Dasher, half of our farm is actually native unbroken prairie and wetlands. And those are tools, right? I don't look at those as an expense. I can put my animals out there if I graze them correctly. I can take revenue off of that. I can produce honey off of that. But then I can also, I get the benefits of having that diversity because the predators that live in there, like the lady beetles and the parasitoid wasps and things like that, they come off of those fields and then they kill my crop pests. So I just don't, a lot of the regenerative operations just don't have to think about pests anymore because they just have so much diversity in that system.
Lundgren says besides restoring biodiversity, one of the main goals of regenerative agriculture is building soil health, all while producing food that is nutritious. But he doesn't stop there. Lundgren says profitability is one of the most important ingredients for regenerative farming to work. This summer, Lundgren held a field day at Blue Dasher Farm. One of the speakers at the event was Steve Tucker, who farms 4,000 acres in Venango, Nebraska, which is close to the Nebraska-Colorado border. Tucker says regenerative farming has helped his operation become more successful.
In the past, I was lucky to make $30,000 to $50,000 a year just gross, all right? Today, it's a six-figure income, and the first one's not a one, just in a matter of 2 or 3 years, just because I've got different crops doing different things.
Tucker started farming with his grandfather in 1992. He says back then they grew wheat. And that was it. Today, he now has over 11 different crops and 5 different species of animals. His latest addition is mung beans, which he is growing for a snack company based out of Boulder, Colorado. Tucker says all these different crops and animals give him multiple streams of income and builds resiliency into his farm system.
If one thing fails, you've got other things to back it up. And always looking for more opportunities. That's where my mind is what else is out there that I can do?
Tucker says along with regenerative agricultural practices, farmers also need to adopt this entrepreneurial mindset. He says regenerative farmers have to get off the farm and market themselves, which he understands is a hard thing to do.
I was a homebody, didn't like that, but once I started getting out and meeting people and seeing that people, in the course of conversations, they're looking for something, you know, for a particular kind of seed or some kind of something to develop a product with. And then my question is how can I grow that so that we can have a win-win relationship so that I can become profitable growing something that's very unique for this particular customer and give them what they want. You want to be rich, you want to be a want or need finder. Find somebody with a want or a need and find a way to fill that.
Tucker says not everything he has tried has worked out. For instance, he tried growing faba beans once and they failed, but he was able to experiment without worrying about losing the farm. Tucker says another reason why his farm is profitable is he uses less inputs like pesticides and fertilizers. He says his herbicide use has gone down 70%, and he hopes to eliminate all chemical inputs completely. But Tucker says it's important to understand that there will be a transition when converting to regenerative farming. One farmer that is going through that transition in South Dakota is Seth Evenson. He farms 320 acres of land that his family homesteaded generations before him near Toronto, South Dakota. Evenson says his family used to mainly grow corn and soybeans, but that it was harder to generate income on those two crops alone on a small farming operation.
It keeps costing more to grow anything. You know, the inputs is getting higher, you guys got to add more chemicals. The more chemicals we use, Mother Nature throws it back in our face tenfold, you know, and laughs at us. So it's like, well, something's got to change. If we quit fighting everything and quit, you know, you'll go broke trying to fight everything.
On top of that, Evenson says his neighbors have ripped out their tree belts and the extra water flowing from the neighbors' farms started causing erosion on Evenson's land. So he switched to no-till farming, then planted cover crops every year. He started polycropping, which means he plants more than one crop in a field at the same time. He also brought animals back on the farm. They now have goats, sheep, cattle, and pigs. He says the transition isn't necessarily easy, especially because there is little flexibility in our current agricultural system.
You know, like in the fall, you go to the banker and we're like, well, we're going to plant corn and oats. But then when the, you know, next spring comes around, we want to have the flexibility to say, okay, let's scratch all that because it's just not working.
Evenson says a lot of people think he is foolish and are waiting for the farm to fail. But he says it has all been worth it. For one thing, farming has become more fun. He likes seeing all the different crops developing at different times of the year. Right now, for him, it's one giant experiment, but hopefully not without reward.
If it's successful, we'll have, well, a couple of the fields, they'll smoke any other corn and beans. It'll be very profitable, if it works.
It's small farms like Evenson's that Dr. Jonathan Lundgren says may be one of the most beneficial aspects of regenerative agriculture. Because if small operations can be profitable, that means younger generations can start coming back to their family farms, which means this type of farming not only helps regenerate soil, but can help regenerate small communities as well.
The South Dakota State Department of Education has released its annual report card. State Secretary of Education Ben Jones joined SDPB's Lori Walsh for an overview.
For people who aren't familiar with the report card and want to access it online and kind of learn not only about what's happening in the state, but what's happening in their own school districts, walk us through what exactly, you know, what data is available to South Dakotans.
Sure. Well, they can see the results of several things that we measure. First off, they can go in and see how their school district does with, say, the ACT scores that their 11th graders, 12th graders took. They can go on and see the certification rates of the teachers in the school and statewide. There's a fair amount of kind of statistical and demographic data about the 135,000 children in the public school system. But the thing that draws the most attention, clearly, is the South Dakota State assessment results that we give generally in April of every year to the school districts and the students in them in grades 3 through 8 and then in grade 11. And they all take the test with some exceptions for
those on IEPs and so forth. But those students are take the exams in English, language arts, and math that's relevant, and science that's relevant for their grade. And then the results are what's reported in the report card this year.
All right. We're going to get to those results in a moment. But first, I want to talk about, from a big picture for you as Secretary of Education, what are some of the bright spots from the report? What encourages you from the data that you've seen for the 2018-2019 school year?
Sure. Probably the biggest bright spot, I think, was the growth in English learners. And they improved markedly over the scores last year, I think 12 percentage points up from what they did. And we believe that's correlated with the amount of teacher training and the increased number of certified teachers who are teaching reading and ELA and language skills to non-native speakers. So if they're children, let's say, who have immigrated here and they speak, say, an African language or Spanish in the home, or the Hutterite colonies who speak German in the home, they would be evaluated on this score, and they were making progress greater than last year. And we think that's a clear sign of a greater number of qualified teachers to teach to those children.
All right, so that number of students considered on track to English language mastery grew from 33% to 45%. So, and this is a growing population as well, overall.
It is, yes, and we've seen a number of districts. You know, there was an article recently, and I think it was the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, and New York Times ran it as well, that Huron, South Dakota has the greatest or the fastest growing numbers of immigrant children, immigrants in the community. And, of course, then that impacts the school district, too. And I think Brookings was also in the top 20 in the nation when you talk about the rate of growth. So Huron has really done a great job in the school district there in reaching these kids and getting them where they need to be.
The report card says there's also progress for getting students ready for post-secondary education. Percentage considered coursework ready jumped from 64 to 68%, another plus.
Right, and we attribute that work due to the growing number of students who are taking dual credit courses or AP courses, and getting to, you know, when you take a dual credit class in college composition, let's say in the South Dakota public university system, it's English 101, and you take that as a senior in high school, and you get a A or a B, that indicates that you're ready for college-level credit-bearing work in English, and certainly that your writing is ready to go. And so that we take that as an indicator that the public school system got them to where they need to be, and now they've validated that by taking that college-level class as a high school student.
So there's lots to go through in this report, and we do encourage people to go online and sort of dig into the data. But I want to ask you about the gap, because that's something that I know that you're concerned with, because as you look at particularly Native American students, it's very stark as you go through the numbers. Also economically disadvantaged students, Black students. There are all kinds of gaps between, you know, students who have some advantages and students that don't. Tell me about how you approach some of those numbers and think about ways to address the widening gap.
Right. I think, you know, one of the things I did in my job prior to coming here, I was at Dakota State, and we got a grant to think about how the university could change its structure from recruiting to teaching to mentoring and working with students, particularly from economically disadvantaged backgrounds or Native American students. And what I learned in running that grant was that there was a considerable amount of barriers, for lack of a better word, or everything from the calendar to someone coming from, say, Cheyenne River and coming to a university, and now the calendar is not quite matching, or a lot of other things that they had with their background just didn't set them up well for that. Filling out the FAFSA, you know, even for the most Well, I my daughter started as a freshman this year in college.
Mine too, FAFSA. I got you.
Yes, yes. I think we've talked about that before. Yeah. That is just a painful, painful process. It is. I think it's worse than doing your taxes because taxes are a part of it, and then that goes on to the other thing. So, if you're a foster child, or if things it's not a typical family life, and you've been maybe bouncing from home to home, the ability for you to sit down and do your FAFSA is just non-existent.
Right.
It is a high hurdle to overcome. So what are the things that can be put in place at the college level to help kids do that, or at the high school level to help do that, help kids do that? And as I came to this position then, I just thought, what are those barriers that we have just kind of gotten used to that are a part of the environment that we don't even necessarily notice anymore, and what can be looked at and examined and reorganized to do that? So even before the results this year came out, I spoke to the governor about closing the achievement gap, and the group I chose to focus on was economically disadvantaged, largely because they're in every town across the state. About a third of our kids, depending on which school district you look at, fall in this category. Technically, it's defined by those children on free and reduced lunch. And so as that gap then was clear in the last 3 years of testing, and this is a nationwide problem, so what can we do? So I wanted to pull together a group, and the governor said, go for it, essentially. So we had our first kind of table-setting meeting on at the end of August, and we're setting up for a second one here where we bring together folks from around state government and also from different school districts around the state. So we had Huron come, Rapid City, Wagner, Sisseton, Sioux Falls participating, Belle Fourche, Hovind, Sisseton, kind of get, just geographically spread around large and small school districts and with the different demographics and so forth. And so we started a conversation about what are the structural things, the administrative things having to do that we can change or take a look at doing. At this point, I don't know if any recommendations will be ready in time for the session coming up in January. But this, we look at this as a kind of a five-year project and hope to see some impact, in 2 to 3 to 5 years.
Does that include the tribal schools as we look at the Native American students and American Indian / Alaska Natives? Yeah.
Yep. Oglala Lakota School District is in there. I neglected to mention them, as well as Sisseton and Yankton and so forth. So we did, and Rapid City and Sioux Falls, the Native American students, most of them are in those two school districts.
Right.
So...
Are you standing
on a reservation or not?
Yeah, are you standing? I'm thinking of former Secretary of Education Melody Schaap, and the fact that this is not a new conversation. As you said, it's a national conversation. Do you have access to a lot of efforts that have happened in the past as you have this conversation as well? And what might some of those be?
Well, what I think I'm trying to do is just trying to, the problem is oftentimes looking at how do you eat the elephant? It can be intimidating to think about the achievement gap and think about all the things that impact a child's learning that are not only inside the school or inside the educational system, but outside the school. And what are the things that can be done in the entire environment and so forth? The governor's push from running for office, and I heard her say it again yesterday at a school visit we did in Wagner, South Dakota, that she's very concerned about what she does, the decisions that she makes, how do they impact families. And so I think this kind of fell within that framework of supporting kids and their learning, and as they grow up and become adults and so forth, that and start their own families to be setting them up better than they otherwise would be. But I think as far as, if this was an easy problem to solve, it would have been solved a long time ago. I think what I'd like to do then is to figure out, given the elephant that we're dealing with, how can we begin to kind of take out pieces and work on those pieces. So if we look at it from, say, third grade reading and eighth grade math, so that's the two things that the state's been measuring for quite a while, not just 4 years, but in one way, shape, or form for over a decade now. And that's the kind of the pivot points that educators around the country see as really crucial. If you can read by fourth grade at grade level, you're far better set up to go to college if you can do that. If you have competency in eighth grade math and you're set up for high school math, then you're far better set up for post-secondary careers and life. So we're going to focus on the gaps of those two items, third grade reading, eighth grade math. And then when you narrow that down, then you come up with a certain kind of defined number of students. And I think with the school districts that we have participating, those numbers of students, which are in the low hundreds, then are kind of doable. And then you can look at that and say, okay, how could X school district contribute to getting another 50 kids across the line? And then all of a sudden, it's not this massive kind of elephant. It's just dealing with one part of the problem, and that over time then could make a big difference.
And I know you have to go, and I just one more question, if you could try to answer in 30 seconds or so. You know, we started the conversation talking about how much progress was made through training and qualified teachers. How big of a component do you think qualified teachers, well-paid teachers, well-trained teachers are going to be in closing the achievement gap as well?
Well, they're essential. And I know that teachers and principals work on this challenge every day with the achievement gap. And so what I want to do is make sure that we're setting them up very well. Part of the work group consists of one of the deans of the colleges of education in the state university system from SDSU. Dean Thorngren has agreed to join us. So what are we doing to prepare teachers as they're working through their bachelor's degree program? And then also, what are the workshops and the professional development that we can provide them that's got the most bang for the buck? So we think, and I would guess I'd focus on, again, if the push is toward third grade reading and eighth grade math, what is the math in elementary and middle school? Are the teachers teaching to the standard for that? And was the reading in K through 3 and ELA, and are the teachers prepared to teach the standards to that? And then break it down by school district and so forth. And that's not necessarily, you know, if they're not teaching the standard, that's 9 times out of 10, that's not the teacher's fault. That's somebody else up the chain from me to the principal that hasn't provided that. So that's what I want to make sure that that teaching to the standard has been available to that teacher.
Tenants at the former Star Academy have received an eviction notice from the state of South Dakota. Former legislator Dan Ahlers is now a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in 2020, and does free speech push the rule of law? It's time to take a listen to this week's Dakota Political Junkies. Joining us were former lawmaker and Rapid City Journal columnist Noel Hamill and Madison Daily Leader publisher John Hunter.
I want to start with some columns that both of you wrote. And John Hunter, let's start with you, because in the Madison Daily Leader, you talk about what's happening in Box Elder with the city attorney. Give us an update of what we know and mostly what we don't know.
Well, of course, this is quite a distance from Madison, so I'm relying on other journalists to fill me in on this. I don't have first-hand experience, but the city of Box Elder has paid its former city attorney $100,000 less payroll deductions and so forth in exchange for her resignation. That is in addition to her salary. And so it's been kind of quiet now. The Rapid City Journal did some nice work in trying to dig this up, but by and large, city officials in Box Elder have not at all released the reason for this extraordinary payment. I call it extraordinary, meaning it's not ordinary for when you ask for resignations or have termination like that to have a large payment like this. So they did eventually release a kind of a separation agreement, but redacted some things, and it really didn't say, well, it didn't say it at all about the reasons for this. So my argument in my column indicated that the citizens of Box Elder deserve to know what this is all about. Why did they have a four-hour mediation session behind closed doors? Why the separation? Why the termination? The city attorney is a public official, and by all matter that I can think of, the citizens of Box Elder deserve to know.
Noel Hamley, would you like to weigh in on the notion of what citizens have deserve to know as government being public trust?
Absolutely. And, you know, I've seen so many cases like this over the years. And, you know, elected officials will, I hate to say this, but they'll hide behind the privacy shield. They'll say, this is a personnel issue, this is a privacy issue. But I'm totally in agreement with John Hunter. I thought his column was right on target. You know, and there are exceptions, but in general, when tax dollars are expended, if you're gonna charge tax dollars, $50,000 or whatever it is, the public really does have a right to know, especially in this case, why they have to expend this money. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, I know that there have been exceptions where tax dollars are used for certain programs. A lot of them are juvenile, and privacy is needed. But if you are paying a public official or a former public official to sever the contract, it's just really outside the realm not to make that public.
And John Noel said, you know, half of this is their money, but the other half is kind of their money too, right? Because how does this sort of work with where the money is coming from?
Right. There is a kind of a common, you'd call it insurance. It's not a company per se. It's a more of a pool, kind of an insurance pool among cities. And so that comes from that. Now, granted, it appears as though that's distant money, but frankly, Box Elder and many other cities pay premiums into that, and that money gets used, whether it's used by Box Elder, or in this case, a portion of that would be directly from Box Elder. On the other hand, if a settlement is made in Aberdeen or in Yankton or any other part of the state, part of their premiums would go to that too. So it is taxpayers' money, primarily Box Elder taxpayers. And in some cases, rate payers, if you have a municipal electric and they use that municipal electric money to fund government, anyone who pays an electric bill, even if they don't pay property tax or pay sales tax or anything else, you know, frankly, if you're a citizen of that entity, you deserve to know.
I want to move on to a column that Noel Hamill has written for the Rapid City Journal that was published on September 29th, and you could read it at rapidcityjournal.com, the full words there. But this is about the South Dakota so-called riot-boosting legislation that Governor Noem was supportive of during the last legislative session. Now, the provisions of those laws, most of them have been put on hold by federal judge Lawrence Pearsall, with a preliminary injunction. And Noel says, hey, not so fast. We need to think about exactly where free speech begins and ends. And Noel, take it from here. What are your thoughts?
Well, just a little background, Lori. You know, the legislature in 2019 passed Senate Bill 189 and two felony statutes. The intention of the lawmakers, and I think it was well-intended, was to address costs for anticipated rioting that could result from building Keystone Pipeline through South Dakota.
Anticipated rioting or anticipated protesting?
Well, okay, that's part of the discussion, isn't it? I mean, peaceful protest is absolutely part of our rights and constitutional rights. Rioting, by definition, can cross that line, and a result might be damage to property. It might be damage to the environment. But what the lawmakers intended to do was to write some legislation that would protect them and protect taxpayers in the event that this occurred. Now, that was taken to court, and that decision was appealed. I mean, the North Dakota protest judge stayed the project, and that decision was appealed, but then the Trump administration issued a new permit in March, and that's what was at the center of the hearing in Rapid City in June, which was a fascinating hearing, I thought. The plaintiffs argued that the new laws created a chilling effect on free speech and association, and prevented them from soliciting support to protest the project because they said that they were afraid of criminal prosecution. They worried about damage awards against them, and so the judge, a couple of weeks ago, Judge Pearsall, as you pointed out, did fine for the plaintiffs in large part. He left intact some of the original statutes that South Dakota had on the books. But basically, he said that the new laws had gone too far. They were vague, it was an overreach, and that he focused really, Lori, on three or four words, which I hope we can discuss a little bit. In essence, what he said, if somebody directs you to do something, that's not protected. But if you simply advise somebody to do something or solicit funds, that is protected by the First Amendment. And that was one of the reasons that these laws were enjoined by Judge Pearsall.
We're going to bring you back in here in a minute, Noel, but I want to include John in the conversation. And John, this is, there's really a nationwide effort from different states to enact legislation that many people are saying, I think is legislation in Texas, and some activists were arrested, and they said, we're passing this legislation to protect critical infrastructure, and the activists say, we're living in a day of climate change activism. Here it comes, and you can't stop civil disobedience because we're on a mission. So, John Hunter, as we look at this, is really a bigger conversation than what's happening in South Dakota, but it is balancing these two things that we hold dear, public safety and the right to assemble and the right to protest, the right to have civil disobedience.
Boy, Lori, I think you're right on the fact that these are balancing two things that we really like. Mm-hmm. We like freedom of speech. We like the right to protest. We like all those kind of things. And we also like public safety. And we like the fact that you shouldn't damage public property at the expense of taxpayers. So, yet it is a balancing thing. And in this case, I think it's in Noel's analysis was good. That Judge Pearsall was focused on things that were vague that probably need to clean up. So I'm going to take one step back in the fact that this legislation was passed fairly hastily without much public input in the last legislative session, which to me means it needs to go through another process, and that is by Judge Pearsall issuing the preliminary injunction. I think what that is going to lead to is modification of this law. It will maybe become more specific. It may include some things. It may take some things out. But in lieu of a good, solid legislative process where a bill is introduced and heard and all those kinds of things, remember, it came in on a placeholder bill
right
near the end of that. It's absent all that stuff that should have been done. Now we'll have to do that stuff anyway. So it's another rule to learn is go through the process correctly at the beginning, and you can perhaps avoid some of these challenges here. But I think there is a solution to be reached in terms of laws, both here and in Texas and others, in the fact that we want participatory government, we want citizens to challenge their governments. We want them to do it peaceably, and we want that's what the Constitution guarantees is peaceable assembly, and then not to destroy things. So I think there is a solution in there that can be reached. It may bend back and forth over time, but I think it's out there.
And here's one of my big questions. When you talk about, you know, the millions of dollars in damage that North Dakota experienced and the waste and garbage and things that that's not really rioting. That's in some ways the expense of public safety and the expense of cleanup just through thousands of people deciding that something is important enough to show up for. So, Noel, talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, people having a right to gather in mass to protest something that they find incredibly important versus the willful destruction of property, which is something we already have laws against.
Well, there is a difference, and no question about that. You have people protesting, whether it's in downtown Rapid City or Sioux Falls or North Dakota, you know, you're always going to have some public property damage. You'll have some things left behind. There'll be a cost that accrues to taxpayers, and I think most people understand that. To some degree, it's a matter of extent. Maybe it's a matter of deliberate trashing of the environment. All those things can be subjective, but the rioting, the judge was pretty clear. He relied on I think the litmus test for most of this is the Brandenburg decision, Brandenburg versus Ohio, and that's an interesting case that he cited because it brings into the discussion a Klan rally, and the head of the Klan was calling the people there to, that he said that there might be a reason to take action if white rights weren't protected. And the Supreme Court said there's, he has that right to say those things. And that's different from inciting riot or directing riot or controlling riot. And Judge Pearsall said, you know, if you advise somebody to do something or encourage them or even solicit them, that's not against the law. But when you order them or direct them, that's the line that can't be crossed. As far as so that's the difference between protected speech and unprotected speech. As far as the public cost of rioting, I think that would come into play if rioting was actually proved. If it's the public cost to the environment where rioting isn't proved or isn't the factor, then that's a different issue, Lori. And I think that falls back on local law enforcement as they're trying to make sure that protesters have a place and a way to protest and maybe enforce local ordinances that prohibit, trashing the environment.
And John Hunter, there we are with that word rioting versus, assembling. Again, if the police, and a lot of this budget is really a law enforcement budget and having to pay overtime expenses in these small areas in South Dakota, as we saw in North Dakota, just really not being ready financially for the amount of public safety assistance that they were going to need. So if the police show up, John Hunter, in riot gear, it's not necessarily a riot. What's a riot, John?
Absolutely. You're spot on that, Lori, and that is, I think the public does have a responsibility to pay for that kind of prevention or some sort of protection. You know, it really comes to mind if you look back in history and some great public protests of the past. How did those? So you look back at Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial at the Reflecting Pond in Washington, D.C. Who knows how many hundreds of thousands of people were there. That was peaceable assembly. And for a lot of us, that was a great moment in American history. You see, you know, the Million Man March. What about the mid-80s farm crisis where drove tractors to Washington, D.C.? Mm-hmm. We know there was extra law enforcement in place for those. We know there was litter left around or whatever that required some cleanup. And I think those are reasonable prices to pay by collectively by governments and indirect, you know, through payment of taxes. But it gets to when you, you know, knock down the statue of Lincoln at the memorial, that there is a line that can be drawn that goes beyond kind of normal protest. And again, the bigger the crowd, the more of that kind of some sort of cost will be incurred, either it's through law enforcement or some sort of minor destruction. But I think there it can be clear, maybe defined somehow, when you kind of willfully, you know, drive a bulldozer through a building or set a building on fire or, you know.
Right. They
set construction equipment on fire. I remember that with the North Dakota protests. That seems to be on the wrong side of the line.
Right.
Well, and Lori, if I might interrupt, you know, none of those laws or none of Judge Pearsall's ruling would get in the way of prosecuting for actual riot. I mean,
right. You
can still be prosecuted for destroying public property. So that's still intact.
And so I think we'll see more about this in the future, especially with John Hunter's point there that it's time to maybe include some other people in the conversation and not rush this, go back and try to figure out not only what are we trying to address, but what's the best, most effective way to do it, and maybe seeing the consequences of how quickly that legislation was passed. Great conversation. Before we let you go, let's talk about Dan Ahlers real quick, because he's a former state lawmaker from Del Rapids, now running against Governor Mike Rounds as a Democrat. Noel, we don't know for sure. Mike Rounds is having some fundraising going on, so we're assuming that he is going to run, but he hasn't officially announced. Now he has a Democratic challenger and a Republican challenger in Skylar Borglum.
Well, I would certainly think John Hunter would know Dan Ahlers pretty well, since he's from that neck of the woods. I actually served with Dan in the legislature, and he was, just in that limited experience, he was one of those Democrats who I found easy to work with. He, you know, you could have conversations with him. He didn't seem like a demagogue. You could talk about...
Is that how you felt about the rest of the Democrats?
No, it's not.
I just like the way you said that. You know, he wasn't a demagogue.
That's a fair comment, but to answer your question, and there are some demagogues, are there not, Lori?
I would not disagree with you there.
But Dan was, and in fact, in the South Dakota legislature, I didn't find very few. There were demagogues on both sides of the aisle. But what I was trying to say about Dan is that he, you know, you could... And there were a lot of, even though they were in a distinct minority back, you know, in 2009 and 10 when Dan and I were out there together, you could sit down and talk about issues and try to get support from both sides of the aisle. Just because you had the majority didn't mean that you shouldn't attempt to do that. And I always thought Dan was willing to listen. And I hope he felt the same way. I think it's a long shot. I mean... Mike Rounds, you know, his war chest is going to be considerable. I mean, you know, all the numbers would favor Rounds, registration, money, you name it. But I always like contests, and I'm glad to see that the Democrats are going to put someone up.
John Hunter, any final thoughts on Dan Ahlers? I like a good contest, too. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I do like... candidates for both the primaries and the general election. I think that gives voters a choice and have a chance to discuss these things. I think that's healthy for democracy. Certainly unchallenged members of Congress. I'm not even sure the members of Congress like that. I think it's just best. So I'm glad that he is in, and I'm glad Skylar Borglum is in, that they both would bring up a lot of things. We do recognize, Noel brought it up, that our system at the moment favors the incumbency, the ability to raise money, and apparently we're influenced by that. Voters, you know, when people raise a lot of money, it seems to give them an edge at the ballot box. So I wish that were a little bit better balanced, but I'm glad to see Dan in the race.
The South Dakota Supreme Court ended its term with a hearing on Mid-Central Educational Cooperative's handling of federal GEAR-UP funds. The lawsuit in question followed investigations into Mid-Central business manager Scott Westerhaus, who murdered his family and set his house on fire before killing himself in 2015. The case considers if two former Gear Up students can be considered third-party beneficiaries of the contracts between the South Dakota Department of Education, Mid-Central Educational Cooperative, and the American Indian Institute for Innovation. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has the report.
Appellants Alyssa Blackbear and Kelsey Walking Eagle Espinoza filed a complaint against Mid-Central and a laundry list of related parties in 2016. They sued for civil theft, breach of contract, and negligent supervision that resulted in loss of services. In 2018, a Charles Mix County court granted a summary judgment that the students' claims are preempted by the Federal Higher Education Act. Attorney John Heinrichs represents the former students. He argues though the initial grant money came from the federal government, the issue at hand is how that money was handled by state departments and contracted organizations. He asserts his clients are entitled to compensation as third-party beneficiaries of the contracts between the state, Mid-Central, and AIII. Defense attorney Ryland Deinert argues no Gear Up funds have been proven missing, only Mid-Central funds, and students weren't beneficiaries of those contracts.
We have the United States Department of Education working with the South Dakota Department of Education and then subcontracting out to Mid-Central. If anyone is an intended third-party beneficiary in this case, they would be with the United States Department of Education and the South Dakota Department of Education agreement.
But Heinrichs argues underserved students are the reason the grants and contracts exist at all.
They are the primary beneficiaries. The grant language itself and the contracts themselves specifically say that the purpose of this grant is to benefit these students. The state of South Dakota and the Department of Education do not benefit unless my clients benefit.
The state Supreme Court will decide the case at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org. Follow In the Moment on Twitter, @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening.